Hey, it's Millie, and welcome to the Generalist World podcast. This is a show where I interview people from the Generalist World community, and we talk things like the future of work, careers, predictions, their hot takes, and really understand what their squealy careers have looked like. So if you're a generalist who feels like they're living in a specialized world, this is the podcast for you.
Jess, finally we get to chat. The last time we tried to chat, I logged on and my entire island's internet went kaput and we weren't able to chat, and I had to call Edger off a landline to let you know because there was no signal. So thank you for being flexible.
Of course. What a quirk.
Yeah, exactly. You couldn't make it up. So when I was looking through your notes and your background and your profile, I kind of want to start this episode somewhere I'd never have started before. Usually we start and we're like, oh, okay, like, let's pull the threads. If you're open to it, if you're happy, I kind of want to start at a low point. And the reason I want to start at a low point is because the world is pretty topsy-turvy right now, and there's a lot of people going through low points. And I think, like, so many podcasts, so much content is all about like the shiny destination, look where I am now. But we kind of miss that conversation around what that actual journey was like and how people made it through. And so I was wondering, could you take me back to 2023?
Yeah, sure. I'm only finally ready to talk about this now. It took a minute. But I had taken a big leap from a job, a very stable job that I'd had for 15 years. I worked for a subsidiary of Kroger, which is like the giant grocery company in the United States, the biggest one. And I was looking around to see, what can I do next? How do I grow my career? And my answer was I needed to go outside. And so I went the opposite direction of a huge corporate company, and I got a really great opportunity with this woman-owned, very small boutique communications agency. I thought it was going to be amazing. And I got in there and pretty quickly I knew it wasn't a great situation. And Millie, I got fired. After about 2 months, they just totally blindsided me, called me into a little cubicle. The meeting was called something else. The meeting was called like, connect on this project. And they let me sit there the entire day. The entire day.
Okay. Yikes.
And then they were like, and you're actually fired. And I was just, the wind was taken out of me. It was such a gut punch. It was honestly so horrible, so awful. I am the breadwinner for my family. I have a family of five. I carry the insurance, which is a pretty big deal here in the United States. And I was freaking out. I was just crying. Just so many tears, and my self-confidence was completely shattered into a million pieces. So it was pretty terrible when it happened, and nothing like that had ever happened to me before. But now 3 years have passed, right? So I can look back and say, I'm glad that happened to me because it made me think of things in a much different way. That is when I started my own newsletter. I don't know that I would have done it without having that happen. So I started something new. It also, I was very lucky in that I was able to get a new job pretty quickly within a few months, I think 3 months total. I was starting at a new full-time job with the health insurance and all that stuff. So that was a confidence builder. I still feel shaky on my self-confidence in some ways. I think in part because the United States so much is dependent on your job. We don't have a lot of great safety nets. But yeah, it was really tough, but I do think it was a catalyst for me in many, many ways. I don't think without that experience, I would have done the things that I've done since then. I was able to get a couple consulting opportunities, and that was amazing. And then I found Generalist World shortly after that, because one thing also that I discovered in looking back and how had I gotten there, I had let my world get too small. All my connections were through my job. And so I was like, I don't want to do that again. And I also don't want to get my validation all through my job. And so at that point, I really started to focus for the first time on building my own network. I have started to think of it as a web that has properties of being able to catch me in my mental picture. I've found my tribe, I feel like. And the funny thing about it is it's kind of like a diaspora. It's really scattered, but I have these people who are beyond a network. They are my cheerleaders. They think I'm great. They want to see me succeed and are actively cheering for me and pushing me to do my own thing. And so I when I look at it from that perspective in hindsight, and I don't feel like I'm a finished story, right? I'm not like, no, I'm successful. I don't.
Is anyone?
I know. Yeah, right. You're probably lying, or you're like an egomaniac if you really think that.
So many threads to pull on there. And firstly, thank you for sharing. That sounds incredibly tough. And I'm glad. It's so interesting, right? When there's these like moments of, it sounds dramatic, but in some ways a death, where it's like the death of like the identity, the death of the person you thought you were, and and also like, I'm not somebody who gets fired. It's like all of these like narratives come to play. And I'm wondering if there is someone in a similar position where they kind of feel like they're at this like this death moment. Were there any kind of tactical or practical things that helped you find your way through to come to these amazing, like your newsletter, your consulting? Is there anything that kind of stands out to you that was a real like lever to come out of that?
I think it's that there's a lot of people who are really wonderful and don't turn too much inwards in those times. Instead, reach out. And in reaching out, one of the first things I uncovered was this book, Never Search Alone, by Phil Terry. I had done a couple of sort of networking calls, and one person who I settled on calling was a former coworker of mine who I had been watching on LinkedIn and knew he'd done some cool things. He went out and worked for Nike for a while, and then he'd become a consultant. And I reached out to him because I always liked him and felt like we had a connection. And also I was like, well, he seems really successful. Like maybe he'll have the secret sauce, which that doesn't exist, right, Millie? But one of the things he said to me was like, you should read this book. And I was a little skeptical, but because I trusted him, I was like, okay, I mean, what can it really hurt? And that has been a huge eye-opener and unlock for me. I would recommend it. I wish they would give it to kids who are finishing college, because I think it's a wonderful approach. I think, and I don't know if this translates to New Zealand or other places you've lived, but there's a huge emphasis in the United States on figure it out yourself. Lift yourself up by your bootstraps. Like, you need a job. It's your responsibility to get a job. And that isn't really how life works. And this book really emphasizes searching in community and leveraging other people to help you, yes, on this journey. And they even have this whole volunteer thing called job search councils. So if you read the book and then you can like go into the Slack community, and they will match you with other people who are searching for jobs at a similar level to you and on a similar time frame to you. And I think it's just the most incredible thing. I think we should all be in one, regardless of if we need a job right now or not, honestly. So that was a huge unlock for me.
Amazing. I love these like practical, something like a book is such like a practical piece of advice that someone can go out and order. I know that you're a fellow ferocious reader. I know that yes. You're a lover of books. Is, while we're on like lingering here, is there any books that stand out that are like your number one most recommended, the one that you just hand out to people?
Oh, my first love is literature, novels. So that will always be what I recommend. I really think everyone should read Barbara Kingsolver's Demon Copperhead. Have you read that one yet?
No, I'm not familiar.
It is so wonderful. I mean, she's a genius. She's an amazing, amazing writer. And this particular story is an American retelling of David Copperfield, which I actually haven't read. But it follows a young boy as the protagonist. His nickname is Demon Copperhead because he has red hair. And it's set in Virginia, in the rural areas of Virginia. It would be cool for you to read it.
Yeah. Wow.
When you're about to travel, oh my gosh, through that geography, it would be super cool. And it is the backdrop of the opioid crisis in the United States. So it's in like modern times, and kind of the Appalachians have had a very serious problem with opioid addiction. Very sad and very terrible. So this, it follows the story of this young boy who kind of gets sucked in and swept up in this addiction crisis. And the reason I love it, I'm obsessed with empathy. And what you feel for these characters in reading this book is amazing, as if they were people you could turn to and touch. And I think that's really, really important for us right now in this moment, because I think it's the human thing.
Talk to me more about the sentence, "I'm obsessed with empathy."
In the age of artificial intelligence, I think it's our human superpower. My hypothesis is that that is what is getting lost already and will be the major casualty as people sort of ask the question, what can this tool do? Instead of asking, what do people need? What do people want? Who are people? So I've been thinking about how do you make empathy explicit instead of tacit? This is also a topic I'm really, really interested in. And when I say explicit and tacit, those are types of knowledge. I don't know if you're familiar with that concept. It was newer to me. So tacit knowledge are things we just know in our guts. They are absorbed and learned over time by doing, by interacting. So if you know something tacitly, you may not be able to verbalize it. It may be difficult for you to teach someone else how to do it because you just know, because you've been living it. When something is made explicit, it is written down, codified, there's a record of it. So you can verbally tell somebody what exactly you mean. And I've been super surprised how much I personally take for granted as my tacit knowledge and assume others have the same foundation or way of looking at the world. And that's fundamentally untrue. And I think why that's really important and interesting with AI is because a lot of that tacit stuff is baked into how it was trained. It's becoming even more invisible. And what is its tacit understanding? At some point, we're not going to know anymore. And so I think this is a really important moment to capture these things that make us human and literally write them down and share with each other. So when I put that lens onto something like empathy, it's actually very challenging. What is it that we mean when we say that? And layer on top of that, that there's sort of this battle or empathy is woke and unnecessary and actually slows us down. I don't know if you've sort of heard that refrain, but that's in the news. And so I've been trying to sit with that, and it ended up becoming a book manuscript. It's called Close Enough, and it's really written for middle managers, which is where I've spent my career. So you're close enough to the customer to really know them, and you're close enough to power to influence decisions, but you're also kind of stuck in the middle. And so how do we turn that into a superpower rather than a frustration point? And to me, the way we do that is by making empathy explicit. And so the book has this framework that I've developed called the Kindly Framework that really embodies step by step what you need to do as a person in business to understand that you're talking to a person at the end of the day, right? Just because you can make commercials with talking animals doesn't mean that you should, because is that what the person at the end wants? Is that going to feel emotionally resonant to them?
This is so timely, and I would love to spend some more time on this, because obviously you've been thinking deeply about this, and not just thinking, you've been living it for, you know, a decade plus. So if someone is in this position, if they are in this position where they feel like they have all this experience, they are almost close enough to the power, what do they do? What do you advise them to do? Can you talk us through this kindly framework?
Absolutely. So the first letter, K, is know your customer intimately. And I think that word intimately is really important. And this is where my love of reading also comes in. So it's like all my worlds are colliding. I've spent most of my career in marketing. And what tends to happen is that we focus on demographics. What's the zip code wealth of this person? Literally, that's sometimes the biggest piece of data we have about someone. What's their age? Do they have kids? Those kind of, they're called demographics. They are sort of recordable and cold. So the first step is for that person in the middle, and they probably already do this, right? They probably already think this way, but it's to become more disciplined about seeing the end customer as a holistic person who is more than demographics. Sometimes we talk about psychographics. I would encourage everyone to read novels of people like Barbara Kingsolver, Louise Erdrich, Abraham Verghese, people who bring to life other people who are not like you, because that's who we tend to know about, is ourselves and people like us. So to really dig in and try to think of your end customer as a character in a novel, a real person, not a headline, not a statistic. So that's kind of the first step. I is imagine their pain points. So this gets a little bit more practical. A lot of people have heard of the jobs to be done framework, and it's similar to that. I think that's a really good starting point, where you kind of go through a day with the person in your head and think, what problems do they have to solve every single day? But it's also a little bit limiting, because it makes it transactional, like moments that you have to get through. So I would layer on top of that solutions journalism. I don't know if you're familiar with that. It's newer to me too. So this is the idea that news shouldn't just reflect the five W's, why, where, what, when, who, but actually it should give context and be optimistic in going one step further and saying, here's the news, here's the context, here's how some people are solving it or moving towards solving it. So you go out on sort of a note of optimism. So that's imagine their pain points. And then in, I really like, it's name the next. So this is where you start getting into like journey building or thinking about the steps that somebody would need to take to solve their problems or live a better, healthier life. But it's settling on that next step. What's just the next thing that they could do that I, as a brand, can own? And this also comes out of this emergent thinking, which is, again, where we'll have to be with artificial intelligence. We can't architect new worlds and then say, okay, let's go there, and there's no bridge, no road. So you have to be really intentional about that. What emerges as the next best step that you can take? And then the next letter is D, dream their future, which is a build on the name the next. So you're really going to develop then a full journey of what can happen. Because I'm in personal finance right now with a bank, I've been thinking a lot about the homeowner's journey and how it's really long, right? It's not easy to buy a home. And so you may need to be with somebody holding their hand for a decade to get them to the keys to their first home. So I think that's a good example and kind of shows you why you can't be trying to sell them something today. They're not ready yet. So you have to give them something else that they think of you and that you're there with them and that you're playing a longer term game. And the last chapter is LY, which stands for laughter, y'all. I live in Kentucky. I'm not from Kentucky, but I've lived here for a really long time now. And people say y'all here. I don't really say it, but I think I can use it now because I've lived here long enough. So I'm claiming it. And I thought this was going to be a postscript because it's about humor and how brands and companies can use humor to connect to their customers and build their brand. I thought it was going to be like a little postscript, like the shortest section of the book. Turns out humor is insanely important and we should all be using it more. It's maybe one of my favorite sections in the book. There's a lot of research on humor, strangely. It's actually my recommendation now would be to bake it into every single brand, no matter how serious you think you are. Even serious questions, maybe serious questions most of all, are best conquered with levity.
Yeah. And like AI is not funny. Like no, tell AI to tell you a joke. It's not funny. But it is smart, right? As in it has a lot of intelligence and knowledge and facts. And it's like, so yeah, when we say lean into being human, humor totally is one of those things. And I want to shout out someone who I've come across recently. I actually had a call with her yesterday. Her name is Chi, and she runs social at Beehive. And she is so funny. And all of their socials are so funny. The same as, do you guys have Oatly in America? They're so funny. Have you ever read the back of an Oatly packet?
They are amazing. I have a case study of them in my manuscript because they are a very cool company. They have what they call the Department of Mind Control. They literally call it that. And it's their creative department. I've spent most of my career in very big companies that have huge departments. And so part of the problem is that things get siloed. And in most companies, the marketing and creative function, creative usually sits within the marketing department. They are an executional department. Someone else says, maybe the product team, maybe the sales team, they say we have this goal, we need to run this campaign. Hey, marketing, do something clever and execute this. So they're often not invited or involved to be part of the strategy, to sit close to the business problem. So what Oatly has done and why they have packaging like that, which breaks every rule book in the grocery store aisle, right? It's not supposed to look like that. They put their creative department, the department for mind control, into the center of their business. So they have creative people invited to meetings across the business. And so that's where you end up with these quirky decisions that have amazing, amazing results.
That have, you know, two people, one in Scotland, one in the US, talking about it on a podcast. I was literally just before this reading the back of the Oatly packet and of the Oatly like milk. And I was like, what? It's so weird and so fantastic. And it's funny, to your point. It's really funny.
And not a lot of brands do this. I really admire Oatly, Duolingo, and Liquid Death for making humor a central part of their brand. It isn't icing on the cake. It is not how can we make things funny. It is how can we build things that are hilarious as a central part of our brand. I got really down a rabbit hole with Liquid Death. Similar to Oatly, they don't have a marketing department. They have a writer's room and they hire real comedians. That is who is running their show. Comedians. They let them do everything. Name the products. That's what you have. Like, I think they have products that are called like Grim Reaper. Their names are so funny. They're like making Saturday Night Live skits, and that's what they run as their commercials.
Genius. Honestly, genius. And thank you for sharing the Kindly framework. It is so clear. And I want, like, when you were speaking it through, I was like, this could literally be helpful for someone who is a solopreneur, and it could be helpful for Amazon, like, and everyone in between. It's like anyone who has a customer, this framework can be useful for.
That's really cool to hear, because I tend to think of it through the lens of my own experience, and I particularly see a problem with very big companies getting further away from their customer, whereas a smaller startup or a business, a small company, probably hears from their customers more regularly and talks to them. Whereas like a Kroger or a big bank, there's layers between the people who are kind of making the big decisions and the customers who are coming into a grocery store format or a branch bank to do their business. So that's, I think that's really cool that you point out that this could be helpful even for the smaller shops.
Yeah, because even if you're really close, like I am so close to generalists. I'm in the forest and I'm surrounded by the trees and I am the tree as well. So having a framework that I can actually work through means that I can like catch a helicopter up to the top of the forest and be like, ah, okay, now I can kind of like get some air and be able to see the full picture of it. So I think frameworks are just so helpful no matter what size you are.
I love frameworks. I just think they're, I hate templates and I love frameworks. Like templates are binding and restrictive and they make me sad. I'm like, well, do your template. But frameworks feel flexible and more philosophical and I can apply them how I see fit across different scenarios. To me, that's the difference.
So true. And one of my favorite parts of GW is it's like having this hive mind of genius generalists who have collected these frameworks over decades. And like, I mean, Robert comes to mind as like, if you have a question, Robert probably has a framework for like the answer for it. I think some people think in them and I'm just like, and it actually comes back to your explicit model before where it's like they have learned something and then they have explicitly turned it into something that can be shared and has been written down and can be remembered. And yeah, do you have any like advice for me really when it comes to, I have all this knowledge that I'm picking up every day and because I'm kind of a creative, chaotic, visionary type founder, my super skill is not in codifying that knowledge. So do you have any advice for people like me who want to create these more solid frameworks? Like you've done such an amazing job with Kindly.
That's such a great question. I resisted it for a while because I was like, everyone knows this. This just makes sense to me. And I was like, it's going to be boring to write it down because I already know it. So I would challenge you maybe to ask yourself, could it actually be an interesting experience to write it down? Could it be more discovery? Because that's what happened to me. I started writing it down and I was like, oh, actually, I thought I knew this, but as I try to write it down for someone else, there's a hole there. I'm going to need to go do some research. And so I go out and do some research or talk to some people. And then I was like, oh, okay, I think I understand how to write it down now to explain it to myself and to other people. So it ended up being more discovery than I thought it would be, which was super surprising to me and interesting.
That's a framework in itself. It's like how to develop frameworks as like a discovery mechanism. I guess it's like a feedback loop, right? Where you're like, if I want to make the greatest framework that I possibly can, it's going to be this process emergent. All these threads are starting to come loop back in this conversation and it's juicy and delicious and I'm loving it. One thing I want to touch on is your newsletter. You mentioned your newsletter. So what was the decision to firstly start a newsletter? And where is it today? How is it working?
So my newsletter is called Pink Pineapple Post, but I am pretty sure I'm going to transition to Close Enough to match the book title and because it feels more who I am now than when I started it. So that's a cool thing about starting your own thing, right? I've been writing professionally, published for almost my whole adult life, probably starting in my early 20s. I started getting things published. And so I've always written for audiences and on assignment. And I wanted to start my own website or blog or whatever for a long time. And I just never really did it. And then I reconnected to a friend of mine from high school. His name's Kevin Burkopes. He's this crazy smart person who has a PhD in math. And he also does like websites and design. And he started his own Institute for Higher Learning. And he hired me for some consulting stuff from his institute called Math Track Institute. And I told him I wanted to start a website. And he was like, okay, I'll do it for you. And I was like, uh-oh, like this means I'll have to actually do this because he took away some of my barriers. And I was like, I think I know what I want to write about-ish. Content strategy, writing, marketing. But I had never written as myself before, which is a super weird thing to say. I had written as brands. I had written for news outlets. But I had to find my own voice and my own topics, right? Like, what do I want to say? And I kind of can see now that I picked Pink Pineapple Post because it sounded cute and it was alliterative and suggested a color. But it doesn't necessarily mean anything. It was an umbrella for me to get started under. And so it was really a process of self-discovery. I've honed my voice. I've honed my topic area that I really want to own, this place of what role does content play within marketing? And how do we bring that to life as the way we talk to customers, to real people? How do we pull that through the whole funnel and not make it transactional, but make it relational? And so recently I moved to Substack. So that's been really interesting. I looked at Beehive and I decided on Substack because it seems like a really good home for writers. And it seems to be the place where people go because they want to engage with longer form content and they want to engage with writers. So that's what I picked. It's been about 6 weeks and it's humbling because it's a new platform. And I brought my list with me, but the people I brought aren't on Substack. So it's kind of like starting over in a way. But yes, that's where I am, trying to learn that new platform, publishing about once a week and seeing what people respond to on that platform. And also, actually, I was really inspired by your posting daily on LinkedIn. I kind of sat with that for like a year, like, whew, that's amazing. Is that something I would even want to try? Mm-hmm. And I decided that in March, I did an experiment where I was like, I wonder what will happen if I just commit to posting every workday, so every 5 days a week on LinkedIn. And so I did that in March for all 31 days. And I was like, you'll have to tell me if this resonates with you. But for me, it was building a muscle. So at the beginning, it was a slog. And I was like, what the heck am I going to write? And it would take me a long time to figure out what I was going to even write about. Did I have a right to put that up there? Was everyone going to hate it? How personal was I going to be? Blah, blah, blah. And then after the 30 days were up, I was like, okay, I've gotten much faster at this. I've kind of seen what do people engage with? What don't they? And A, I don't care, right? Like, it kind of, the more you practice it, the more you're like, eh. Like, I'm shouting into a void to some extent. But some really kind of cool things happen. Some are in IRL, in real life. Like, people would ping me at my work and say, people that didn't even like the post. They'd be like, I saw your post. Or, like, I'll run into people and they'll be like, oh, I saw your thing. I read your newsletter. And I'm like, okay, it would be nice to hear from you on there. But cool.
Yeah, it's so true. And the muscle totally, completely resonates when people say, how do you post so much? How are you everywhere across all these platforms? I'm like, you just do it for long enough. You're willing to be bad. The cost is that you'll be bad at it. You'll be a bit rubbish at it at the beginning. As you said, it's the void anyway. It ain't that deep. People aren't going to notice if you only get 2 likes. And if they do, then they're probably paying too much attention and need to go out and smell the flowers or something. And the opportunity for me that could come from, okay, I spend, you know, maybe at the beginning it's 45 minutes on a post. Now I won't spend more than 10 or 15 minutes because it's just like, dear diary, here's what's happening today. And just the opportunities that have come from that one decision, from that one habit to post on LinkedIn has honestly been beyond what I ever could have imagined at the beginning. So kudos to you. The hardest part really is that beginning bit, posting when you're like, I don't really know. I don't. When you're building the muscle, it's the same as going to the gym. Like, going to the gym is no fun. Going for a run is no fun at the beginning.
Yeah. And I really liked what you said, because I do sort of go back and forth about, well, should I just have this very narrow niche? Should I decide this is who I am on LinkedIn? And I think you were like, we're whole people. You know, I post about what's interesting to you on any given day. So I'm trying to lean more into that. And I still feel like I hold back a ton of myself, because I'm by nature more of a private person. But then I'll be talking to people and they'll be like, I thought that was so vulnerable that you shared X, Y, or Z. And I was like, oh, girl, you have no idea.
There's more.
There's more in there. So that's cool. I think there is. I've also been thinking a lot about the idea of vulnerability, because I think that's, I don't know, do you think that's part of being human?
Absolutely. It's a part of being human, and it's the fastest way that I've ever found how to connect with others. And whenever I'm doing a talk or a panel, I put myself out there, and I will, it's actually almost like, to loop it right back to the beginning, we started at your low point. We started at your low point. And again, thank you for sharing. That was a moment of vulnerability. That was a moment where people, even if they haven't been in that exact situation, will be like, hot dang, we're talking about real stuff here. We're not just doing the fluffy, flashy stuff. So yeah, I think it's a massive part of connecting.
I think so too. And I think it's scary. So people don't do it. Shockingly, I think a lot of people don't do it in a one-on-one setting even. So I think modeling that and being that way in public is maybe almost a public service. Maybe. And that's the first time I thought of it that way, but it is modeling how to be an empathetic human.
I think what I found is it can be really scary to do that in a place like social media, where it's not moderated. It's not a safe place. There is nothing safe about being vulnerable on social media. You are putting yourself out there to be like, it's an open forum. But I think if people are wanting to practice this again as a muscle, community is one of the greatest places you can practice vulnerability, especially when it's a moderated, curated, well looked after, well loved, nourished community. There's no better place. There's no better place to put your hand up and say, hey, I'm struggling with this. Hey, is anyone else going through this? Hey, has anyone else been through this? What worked for you?
I love that you said that. And I think we're making explicit something that I really like about the Job Search Council framework. It's a super safe place to be vulnerable. You know, you build up trust. And so the people there, we can ask each other questions that might hurt coming from someplace else. One of my favorite things to do is to make an observation about people that I get to know better, because the Job Search Council book points out that it's easier for other people to see you sometimes than it is for you to see yourself. And so what a gift to be able to show someone how they appear to you, which is almost inevitably way more favorable than how we look at ourselves. And then there's this other thing that I've been playing with too, which is that I can't control at all how anyone else sees me, what I am to them. And at first that was really scary to me, because I'm like, I want to present how I want to be seen and taken seriously and all this stuff. But more lately, I've been like, that's actually pretty cool, because when I sort of sit with it a little bit longer, usually the person is, if I listen to them, they see me for more than I see myself. I'm listening for the negative. I'm listening for the knock, right? But if I listen a different way, I actually hear a compliment.
I love that. It's so true. It's finding those mirrors. That's how I think of it. It's like having a mirror who can kind of verbalize what's right in front of you, but you just can't see it. And I see this happen all the time in community. Jess, is there anything that I haven't asked you that you wish you had the chance to talk about?
Yes, I can't believe it didn't come up. Will you please ask me about journaling?
tell me about journaling.
I think it's the habit that feeds all the other things that we've been talking about. I hadn't been a steady journaler ever. Like, I would try and then like it just didn't work out. And then Elizabeth Andrews in the Generalist World community, she's like this lifelong journaler. She's been journaling almost daily from, I don't know, age 11 or something hilarious like that. And she runs journaling workshops. And so I joined her journaling workshop in, I guess, January 24. And she sent a prompt each morning to our emails on what to write about in the journal. And it reframed my whole relationship with that practice. And now I journal most mornings. And only for 15 minutes. I don't do it forever. But I think the big unlock for me was that I thought a journal was for private thoughts that you can't tell anyone else, and secrets and getting over the bad stuff. And Elizabeth taught me how to use it as a positive tool, as a tool for optimism and reflecting on what's going well and what you like about yourself and what you see as a future, in a more optimistic lens. And so you can use it both ways. Like, there's no right or wrong way, but I hadn't considered that you could use it for really positivity, I guess, and optimism.
Do you have a favorite prompt or two that we could leave people with?
Yes. Probably my favorite style is called, I call it HW, or higher wisdom is what it stands for. So it could be anything for you. If you are religious, you could talk to God, you could talk to your inner voice, whatever it is. But it's a conversational approach. It's a dialogue. So if you have a question that you've been struggling with, you ask the question in your journal and wait for what the other voice inside you says back. And then you talk back and forth.
Wow. Powerful. I can already tell.
It's so weird because you're like, I'm only talking to myself. Where is this information coming from? I'm not that wise.
But I guess I am, because it's written on the paper. That's an amazing prompt. Thank you so much. Is there anything else that we missed? Anything else that you wanted to cover?
I guess there is one more thing.
Go on.
I didn't get to talk about it earlier. It's a build on Close Enough. I'm making an app, which is something that we can all do now because of AI. But I am bringing that framework to life through an app experience, and I'm really excited about it. I have wireform frames that I drew on paper and gave to, I'm using Claude Cowork. I'm using Claude Cowork and then anti-gravity for the build. So right now I'm just in the phase of really nailing down the experience and what it feels like to the user, and then I'll go into to development. But that's just something I never ever imagined I would do. I've worked on apps before, but with a partner, you know what I mean? And I was like the non-technical person. And so it was a little scary at first. I was like, I don't think that I'm smart enough to do this. But that's not the right question. It's called the Close Enough Persona Generator app, and it's part experiential and part artifact output. So it's doing that work that we talked about putting yourself in a customer's shoes and really working on your empathy muscle, building that. So there's like some free writing within the app. And then after a few steps, it will output a persona for you and a little write-up about the person. It's meant to invite you back in multiple times so that this becomes a practice of putting the customer at the center.
That makes total sense. And we will be sharing all of your links in the show notes. So make sure that you link all your stuff, and then people will be able to get in touch and follow the journey.
Thank you so much for this wonderful conversation. So fun.
It's been winding. I have literally like a whole pages of notes. So thank you so much, Jess. I can't wait to share this with the world.
All right. Thanks so much, Millie.
Thanks so much, Jess.
Have a wonderful day.
You too.